Okay, so we're down to the last two topics of the course. The first of those two is information extraction, and that would be today and also tomorrow on the makeup class. And then the other two classes would be on information integration. And they're all basically from the slide that I mentioned about structure on the web, the very first slide on the structure on the web. How to get structure, how to represent it, how to extract it, how to use it. Okay, that's basically what we're doing. So that's what I'm going to do today. Before I start, are there questions? Yes, sir. Yes, on everything. Very quickly. Yes, I mean definitely on the information extraction, and then there'll also be on the information integration. As I said, those basically everything will be due on the last day of the classes, so that's why as soon as they're added, you're better off doing them right away. Other questions? Okay. So again, the makeup class tomorrow is going to be from 10:30 to 11:45 and BY 210, which is next to the advising office. Okay, just so I know approximately how many people think they might be able to show up tomorrow. Okay, good, thanks. Okay, so what I am going to do is basically, rather than just directly jump into information extraction, I want to go back to last class's last few slides, which sort of provide the reason as to why we will be considering information extraction. If you remember, we talked about, in the last class, we talked about XML as a way of representing the syntax of a page, and then we also talked about querying standard for XML, XQuery, as well as IR-style querying of the web, of XML. Then we talked about semantic web standards, where we agree upon a syntax for representing basically the base level facts as well as the axioms of a subset of a first order logic theory. Okay, the base level facts are represented using the RDF standard, and the background knowledge is represented using the OWL or the RDF schema standard. Okay, so RDF schema is old, OWL is the new one. Okay, and then there's like a whole bunch of people who are pushing these standards of semantic web. Now the question that we talked about the fact that they have semantics and that they can make, you know, we can, that there are these standards and that we could understand them by saying RDF is the base level knowledge and OWL is the background knowledge. Okay, so now the question of course is, how are you supposed to be using this? So the intended use of semantic web is that these pages will have multiple views. Okay, so this is the rendered version of the page. This is, you know, Jim Handler's page. And then he also, if you look at the source of his page, he also has a bunch of annotations. He's basically talking about some of the information that's present on the page in terms of, you know, using basically RDF triples. And also, it's not enough to just write RDF triples. You need to then make a pointer to the background knowledge that combines the RDF triples into each other. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's not enough to say, you know, X teaches the course Y. Okay? You don't know what teach means. You don't know what course means. Okay, so there has to be a background knowledge which talks about if X is teaching the course Y, then X cannot be the student of course Y, for example. That's a piece of knowledge that you happen to have. Okay, and that is there because it's in the background knowledge. It has to have been represented somewhere. So the nice thing about doing it on the web is that somebody might have represented all the background knowledge for subsets of the words that you're interested in different files. And if you are going to use their vocabulary in the RDF triples, then all you need to do is put a pointer to their background knowledge. That's the basic idea. So it works nice, you know, at least you don't have to write your background knowledge, you just make a connection to theirs, and you just add some facts on top of it. Okay? So the then the, of course this is basically the there is stuff that, that's being rendered, but there's also part of the stuff that has structure, which is basically not only does it have a structure, in fact that structure has semantics. Okay, and presumably you can then ask questions, I mean you can combine pieces of information from different pages and answer queries. So this is the dream of semantic web. Okay, now of course the first question is who is actually going to annotate pages like this? Okay, that's the issue. So now Jim obviously annotated his page like this, but you know that's because he's one of the guys who's pushing semantic web. And he wants to make sure that, you know, at least there's a page which actually has these annotations. The real question, of course, is, you know, which, for other people who, you know, are they going to, how are you going to make sure that they are all going to, they're all going to annotate their pages? And this is the part that I was talking about last class, about the fact that, you know, if the motivation is clear. If you annotate your page, if you annotate your page, then presumably people can reason about your page and its relation to other pages. Okay, but that may or may not be strong enough motivation for you to actually take the time to annotate the page. Okay, this is why I was saying that the motivation for cleaning the rooms are clear. You know, you can find things that, you know, that are actually in the room. But, you know, people keep telling you to clean your room, but you did not clean your room when you were a kid. Okay, maybe you don't clean even now, just that nobody tells you anymore. So the question then is, how do you make sure that, you know, the structure is put on the web? Okay, so there are essentially the zeroth idea, which is let's just hope that people will be nice and they'll put the structure themselves. Okay. The problem, of course, there too, there's a major problem, because ultimately you want to make sure that if you are using some RDF triples, you better make sure that you put the right pointer to the background knowledge that defines those RDF triples. So you need to have the all, some, you know, all, by the way, the word ontology is used for background knowledge. Okay, in semantic web a lot, because essentially, although logical background knowledge in Pashtada logic, background knowledge may be more than just an ontology. An ontology is essentially things that you are talking about and the hierarchical relationships between them. Pashtada logic might have more than just that information. However, as I pointed out last time, semantic web standards basically look at description logic subset of the first order logic, where really the background knowledge is all about this is a subset of this class is a subset of some other class, and so on. So you can just say background knowledge is nothing but ontology. Okay, that's the reason you keep hearing that word. Okay, so anytime in the semantic web you hear ontology, think background knowledge. That's basically the simplest way to think about it. Okay, so we have to assume that people connect this, and then that hope is that somehow, and then if there is somebody else who has given different relation names for the same thing. So here you are thinking in terms of course and teacher, and these guys are thinking in terms of course and instructor, and somebody else is thinking in terms of course and instructor. So you have RDF triples in terms of course and instructor, and then they put a link to a background knowledge which defines courses and instructors. And you need to put yet another common background knowledge which combines these two, saying instructors are nothing but teachers and courses are the same. And if in fact the course here is different from the course here, that also needs to be explained here. So this is the assumption that there is this web of these knowledge bases that are connected. And so the moment you add an extra sentence in some page at the bottom level, then you have a huge amount of inference that is possible. And for those of you sometimes it's not obvious as to what possible inferences might you be interested in doing, you know, when given knowledge, okay? So if you are ever in doubt, let's think of the following story. This is something that I normally keep telling in the intro to AI. So here is a story. There is an explorer called Magellan who went around the world 3 times, okay? On one of his trips, he died, okay? Now the question, which trip did he die? No, the question is, the point of course is, I hope you know the answer. Okay, you don't need to. If you don't know the answer, you're in really big trouble. Okay, but where in the story did I say which trip did Magellan die? Nowhere. Okay, where is the background knowledge that made you realize that if somebody dies, then you don't think of them as going around? In fact, what happened to Magellan is he died in the middle of the third trip. So the second half of the third trip, he was a dead man. He was going around the rest of the globe, you know, as a corpse. Okay, but the point is, where in the story did I say this? Nowhere. And a 4-year-old who understands normal common sense can answer this question. Okay, this is basically the advantage of having background knowledge, so that simple facts. No, if I told you that story and I asked you, you know, obvious questions such as how many times did Magellan go around the world, you know, that is a question too. You can answer that. Who went around the world? Magellan. Okay. What did he go around? World. These are silly questions with easy answers. But the question that I was interested in, that all of you know the answer to, is which trip did he die in? And you can start thinking about how does that background knowledge get represented in your own brain. Do you have like a specific knowledge saying if explorers go around the world up to 10 times, then if they die, they would die in the last trip? Do you have that knowledge? Do you have much more general knowledge that you can't do a thing after you're dead? Okay, and then that will then get specialized to this particular case in point. So this is, of course, the beauty of background knowledge and inferences. If you ever forget about why should I care about background knowledge, you know, then that's the kind of thing you have to ask yourself. Now, of course, you can avoid asking that question. You can give this comprehension question and only ask easy questions, such as how many times did he go around, and you don't need the background knowledge. Okay? So the hope is that if everybody writes all this background knowledge, then, in fact, you can actually write RDF triples and you'll be done. Okay, within AI, there has actually been bunch of attempts at. One of the interesting things is that if you are talking about, let's say, something like common sense knowledge, it's called common sense because all of us have it. If only I have it, then it's not common sense. Okay, I mean, I can yell at you saying what's obvious to me is not obvious to you, so you don't have common sense. But if it is common sense, that means all of us have it. Okay, if all of us have it, then only one of us has to write it down. Do you understand what I'm saying? So one advantage basically is that if you have something like common sense knowledge, you know, for the entire world, can you write it down in some logical format, some knowledge representation format, so that then nobody else has to copy it anymore, and they can write extra facts with respect to it. This has been tried. You know, this has been, there is a reasonably famous project called Psych Project, which essentially tried to write down all common sense knowledge about the world. Okay, what is common sense knowledge? It's the knowledge that a 4-year-old knows. Okay, by the time you're 4 years, you kind of know this knowledge. Okay, the writing that down one. Now, there are various issues as to whether or not you can write these kinds of knowledge in a clean enough form. But assuming that you could do it, then everybody else can make connections to it. Okay. Now, there are certain other things such as knowledge about computer science. That's not common sense. But that too needs to be only written by like one person in all of computer science. And then everybody else can make connections to it and make, you know, statements about it. So this is the beauty. I mean, this is the lure of semantic web. Okay, so it provides a way of actually writing this down so that people can make, you know, hyperlinks. You're doing hyperlinks to other people's brains now, as against hyperlinks to their pages, their brains being the knowledge source, knowledge that you've written. Okay, so of course, then the question, of course, is people, there already are large number of pages that are on the web and they don't have the structure. And there are more pages that are coming up, they don't. There is no way you can make them have that structure because, you know, web doesn't work like that. You can't tell people you must behave. Okay? So, there is, other than Jim Handler, not too many people put, you know, semantic annotations on their pages. So how do you, you know, so then basically is this whole dream gone? Is this whole idea of having background knowledge, you know, which will allow you to make assertions and make inferences over the knowledge in the individual pages, is that gone? Okay? Well, it's not. We can think of basically in the rest of today's class as well as next class, we'll talk about, basically we can talk about three different methods, of which I'll spend more time on the third one. Okay, the first method essentially is intercede in the way pages are created. Okay, people want to just create their pages using, nobody other than me creates pages by actually editing HTML. Okay, everybody uses some page creation software, you know, either a front page or Claris home page. I think Claris home page is dead and gone, but front page or something, you know, right? So now the point is, those are already, so you're already going through a mediator where you are telling them what to write and then they are putting that in the HTML standard. With some effort, you can make these guys ask you certain well-placed questions. These, you know, pieces of software ask you certain well-placed questions which can then allow them to write down the RDF triples too in the background. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so it's again, asking questions at the right time might get you answers. If after the page has been created, if I come and ask you, so what do you think is the RDF triples for your page? You have no interest in answering. But when you were creating it, you know, I could have interceded. Okay? This is one idea. Yes, sir?
Are you familiar with
That's sort of the idea. I mean, I don't quite know whether or not they also develop, you know, RDF triples. See, again, remember that syntax and semantics are two different things. You can have syntax, you know, representations, but also have, you know, that's not necessarily, you know, subsuming the semantics. Okay? So, so basically, this is the idea that, you know, somehow change the, you know, page creation software such that they slightly add annotations by asking you questions. Okay, now it's again, to make this a general idea, I mean a generally applicable idea, these page creation software should be people. Because only people can ask questions about what you're writing, you know, that will make sense across the board. Okay, but for subsets of domains, you know, suppose, you know, you may be able to, suppose all you're doing is writing pages about, let's say, biological interactions. Okay, then there may be certain questions that make sense, and those are the only ones that are worth asking. Okay, so there is, and you know, some projects such as Mangrove project, which actually I think I have probably a link to it, which essentially try to do this kind of thing, which basically try to ask you questions and give you some instant gratification. So if you explain to me what this entity is, then I may be able to connect it to the background knowledge, and then you may be able to do more inference. Okay, again, this instant gratification thing is a very big deal because people want to see why am I doing this? Why am I being asked extra questions? Why can't I just write HTML page and be done with it? You know, this idea of this will help people that come after you never works. This is why our environment is in the place where it is in. Because if we don't screw up our environment, our children and their grandchildren will have more fun. But do we care? Really? No, we just want to have our fun. Okay. So it's, we want our gratification, and the question is, how do you show the gratification? You know, how do you show the user that if they, because they answered this question, they get a little extra information? Okay, it's a design issue. Okay, the other, of course, is something that you all know, is the collaborative tagging. So many eyes, I mean, there's this beautiful point that, what's his name, Eric Raymond has said that with sufficient eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. Okay, that means if enough people are looking at a piece of code, then there's really not too much of a problem about debugging. You know, somebody will catch that all the bugs. Okay, that basically that's the point about collaborative computing, collaborative reasoning. Okay, and so the question is, if multiple people are looking at this page and they start putting tags to it, okay, saying this string, by the way, is an actor's name, this string is a movie name. Okay, and then once they put those tags, then they can be part of a larger knowledge base, and so you basically you have background knowledge about movies and actors and so on, and that would work too. Okay, so there you can try collaborative tagging. Pieces of collaborative tagging that you already know are things like folksonomies, where people essentially just add tags. Okay, the difference between full tagging, you know, basically providing the semantic web style RDF triples and the ontology versus just tagging by random people saying this word seems to describe this page, which is mostly what tagging involves, right? Okay, when Amazon or somebody says tags, add tags to this. So you just make up more words and just add tags, you know, those become the meta tags for that data. Okay. Now the problem, of course, is that this is a bottom-up approach to developing the background knowledge as well as doing the tagging. Okay. Is there anybody who doesn't know how tagging, I mean, is done on the web? Basically, there are pages, there are places where you can always add tags saying, you know, this is something that this particular page describes. Okay. Now, the one thing, of course, is that folksonomies are very useful because they improve your ability to search for the relevant material by describing what is there underneath. Okay. But it's also decentralized, so people can write whatever tags they want. The only thing that seems to make it work is because there are some incentives to use popular tags. If you want your picture to be seen, right, then there are some incentives to tag it in with the popular tags. So in the beginning, people might be calling a thing by multiple different tags, but then slowly certain popular tags will wind up just, you know, because you show these are the popular tags, those are the ones people will start picking. Okay, that's good, except, you know, ultimately there are problems such as there is no hierarchy, because it's all flat. Normally the folksonomy tags are all flat, you know, you just have, you know, words that come to your mind added to that page. Okay, there is no background knowledge, and some people might be saying, oh, this is a car, and some people might be saying this is a vehicle. Now vehicle is actually a superclass of cars. Is that obvious from the tag? No. Okay, so you could, of course, there may be, you know, one of the very interesting directions right now is how to use folksonomies, how to use the collaborative activity in conjunction with other things. Okay, you know, if you remember in the beginning of the semester, I mentioned some major threads in the entire web-oriented research, and one of which is there are a large number of people looking at the web. And if you can, and their most of their brains are not being used. And so if you can somehow find a way of co-opting them to do work for you, then, you know, you can make miracles. Now the problem is folksonomies seem to be an easy way of making people work because they just add these tags, but that's not enough. You want to go beyond that. Now, we will talk a little bit about what could be done, you know, some of the projects that combine the third idea I talk about, which is information extraction, along with collaborative tagging. Okay, but collaborative tagging by itself doesn't necessarily work as well. Okay, it works to an extent because it improves the search, but there is no full background knowledge that people can just provide. Okay. Now, of course, so the thing is to improve the collaboration, of course, if you are talking about making sure that people do more correct tags, and they just don't game the system and so on, you need to design approaches where the tags they provide are going to be more likely than not the correct ones. Okay, and that gets you out of, you need to have a way. I mean, currently in the normal Fox economy, the only thing that makes sure that the correct ones are the ones that people put is majority. You know, the popular tags are supposedly multiple people are using them, and so this must be really the description of the page. Okay, but if there are not enough people, okay, for like things like Britney Spears page, there may be enough tags, you know, because enough people probably look at it. But there may be many pages for which there are like maybe one or two people who tag it. And if they disagree, what do you know? What's the right tag? Are both required? Are only one required? Or, you know, what's the correct way to go about it? So this is where actually, again, it's an interesting design space where you want a way of incentivizing people such that they are less likely to make up tags to just, you know, defeat the purpose. You understand what I'm saying? So, you know, I think I mentioned the ESP game before, right? Most of you know about it. It's essentially two randomly chosen people look at an image and start writing what comes to their mind, the words that come to their mind. Okay? And anything that falls in both the lists is a good tag, because these are two randomly chosen people, and so they have really nothing to, you know, no incentive to collude, right? And so if it is in fact this, you know, falling in the descriptions of both of them, then it's probably a pretty high quality tag. So that's a very interesting game, right? And then there are other types of such games that you can make, you know, to get people to help you in terms of not only help you, but don't mislead you. Okay. There is another way, which of course you don't allow everybody to tag. You will first, you know, certify taggers and say, these people, you know, have taken some course and, you know, we trust them. So if they tag, then their tags are given higher weight than other people's tags. Now, you know, it might work in small situations. In fact, we'll look at, a project here at ASU called CBIOC that Chitta Baral is involved in, which basically uses this kind of an idea. You have to sign in and you have to be a physician before, or a biologist, before you can start tagging biological abstracts. Because in their case, they're trying to tag biological abstracts, you know, with information. Or in fact, what they do actually is something that is very relevant to the next thing we'll talk about, which is the third idea we'll talk about is automatically extract facts from the knowledge, from the plain text. Now, which you should understand that that's not going to be easy. Unless you have very full, you know, a very robust natural language processing system, your extraction system is likely to be wrong. I mean, you know, at least some of the time. Then you can use users to clean up the knowledge base. Do you understand what I'm saying? Rather than just ask people, describe this, you could say, look, here is a piece of English text. Here are the facts I extracted from this English text. Can you tell me which of them are right? Do you understand what I'm saying? So this is sort of a more directed way of using people's brains. This also has been tried, and then, you know, CBIOC is a system like that. Now again, in that case too, how do you make sure that people don't tell you the wrong answer? You know, to say, heck with it, yeah, okay, you're right. And in fact, you're wrong. The program was wrong in extracting the pattern. Okay? In those cases, again, the same issue. You may have to use something like the ESP game kind of an idea to make sure that when people give answers, they're likely to be speaking the truth, at least with respect to them. They could be dumb, okay, but at least they're not making up facts. And the other one is to restrict the number of people who get to write the tags, and that is the way you make sure that, you know, the accuracy of tags or accuracy of answers is preserved. Okay. So again, and in all of these things, you need to talk about why would people do it for you? Okay, one of the things I pointed out to you is that even though we looked at these three as three different ideas, you can combine all of them. Okay, you can do collaborative tagging along with, you know, some of the tagging being done at the time of the page creation. And then furthermore, along with information extraction, that we'll be talking in a lot more detail in a little while, but also, you know, as you heard, it's like the information extraction, the extracted facts might be inaccurate because of the extraction inaccuracy, and then you have, you know, some ways of ensuring that, you know, that you're getting extra information from the people to say these are actually right. Okay. Now, for people to do anything, you need to make it fun, or you need to make it worthwhile. And you have to either pay them, or you have to provide them some instant gratification because they gave you this information, they got something back in return, or just make it fun and make it a game. Okay, now this again, as I said, this part is, that's not something that is taught in computer science as well, okay, but it's important. If you want free work out of people, it's not enough just to be technically savvy. You need to know how people work, and you need to, you know, use the kind of motivation for people have to make, you know, use them against them so that they'll wind up giving you extra information. Okay. Okay. So there is this, and the third one is automated information extraction, which is essentially you just extract the information, the knowledge from the text yourself. Okay, and that's obviously going farther because you don't depend upon people. Okay, and also you don't have to depend upon pages that, you know, this can only work for pages that are being created now. But if the pages that exist already, there are a huge number of pages that exist already on the web. And for them, you know, this could work, but this won't. I mean, this won't work. So you need to work on directly converting English into knowledge. Okay, we'll talk about that as information extraction. Of course, the very first question you should have in mind is, why a new name? Why do you call it information extraction? Why not call it natural language understanding? Yes, you know, if we know how to do natural language understanding, then you don't need information retrieval, you don't need information extraction. You don't need most of these courses, okay? But unfortunately, natural language processing by itself is a very hard problem. So IR is NLP light, I said. Think of it as actually NLP light, okay? And then information extraction is NLP light, okay? And then NLP, full NLP doesn't exist as yet. Okay, that's the best way to think about it. And of course, again, part of the thing here is information extraction is NLP being done in the context of web. Whereas NLP in general can be done in any other context. We might be having conversations, we have a lot more contextual information, physical gesture information, all this fun stuff, which don't exist on the web. But there are other kinds of things that exist on the web. Okay? So using the web as a resource, trying to do partial natural language understanding is what's called information extraction. Okay? So basically, given some basic English text or some natural language text, you are trying to bring out either the RDF triples or the background knowledge itself out of it. Okay? For now, we will actually assume that all you are interested in is really writing the base level facts. Okay? Or in some cases, you think that the entire page corresponds to a structured tuple, and there are fields, and the fields have to be filled by reading this page. Okay? We'll talk about examples like that. So for example, what you're trying to do is convert the unstructured information to give it more structure. It's all normal text. Now you want to give it a little more structure. It doesn't have to be fully structured. Okay? So it can be applied to different kinds of text, newspaper articles, web pages, scientific articles, news group messages, classified advertisements, medical notes, and we'll also talk about Wikipedia. But Wikipedia, by the way, is the knowledge of the world, right? So if I can apply information extraction to Wikipedia, then I don't need psych. Agreed? Okay, psych was a bunch of people basically writing what they thought was the common sense knowledge that a four-year-old has. Wikipedia supposedly has all of that plus more, but it's all written in English. Okay? And so one question is, if there is a way of converting Wikipedia knowledge into some structured knowledge, you know, Wikipedia English into some structured knowledge, even partially, then you are in good shape because you have like a huge background knowledge ready to go. Of course, Wikipedia has both background knowledge and the base level facts. It has everything, right? Okay, so that we'll look at that too. Now, those of you, you can think of, if you're looking at these, for example, things like many of these are not exactly Shakespearean sonnets. They're all text with very stylized structure. Okay, a newspaper article is written in such a way that the main point of the article is given in the first sentence, right away. Whereas, imagine a Hitchcock movie where the first sentence tells you what happens at the end of the movie. You would not see the movie. But newspaper articles are not supposed to be Hitchcockian movies. You know, this is a thing that your editors will tell you when you're writing it. Give away everything in the first sentence, and then give extra information afterwards. It's a very stylized thing. So if you are actually extracting from the newspaper articles, if you extract from the first sentence, you're already in good shape. Okay, same thing for emails. Emails have structure, right? Partial structure about from whom is the message, what's the subject, etc. And if you extract that information, then even if you don't understand the body, you're fine. Okay, whereas doing information extraction from Moby Dick is hard. I mean, it's hard for people, I think. You know, Moby Dick is this thick book, which, you know, you have to buy a Cliff Notes version, and then that too is a thick book. Okay. So the question, of course, is how can you explain what happens in this book in a couple of sentences by reading the entire book? Okay, and that was written for as a literature. Literature is the worst thing you want to extract facts from. Okay, but thankfully none of these are literature. Web pages are clearly not literature. If you looked at your web page, you realize that. Scientific articles, newsgroup messages, classified ads. Now, in the case of medical notes, there is a very structured way people write, you know, what's the patient's information, you know, when did they come in, etc. And if you get a part of these facts and write them in a structured form, then you have a better way of reasoning with it. Okay? So, now in terms of Wikipedia, by the way, even though Wikipedia is not particularly stylized, it is reasonably stylized. And in fact, we'll see in a minute that Wikipedia, in many Wikipedia articles, have these info boxes, which are essentially capsule summaries of the facts of this article. Who made them? People made them. Okay. Now, not all Wikipedia articles have info boxes. In fact, if all Wikipedia articles have info boxes, then you actually can say that Wikipedia info boxes are to Wikipedia articles what this is to this page. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. So if you can get info boxes written, or you know, if they're already there, if you can somehow, you know, basically they're written in a sort of a tabular format. If you can realize that using the indentation that this must be the property, this must be the value, and write them into facts. Okay, then you're already ahead of the game. And then one of the other interesting things that you could do is if you ever extract patterns from the normal text, you can push it into the info box. Okay, and then if you extracted bad patterns, one of the nice things about Wikipedia is anybody can write anything, and it will stay for 3 microseconds before somebody overwrites it, right? So one of the things that you could do is you could generate information boxes, info boxes for the pages automatically. And as we'll see, any of these techniques that that extract knowledge from text are likely to be inaccurate. So the question then would be, how do you make sure that the info box is actually accurately extracted? Okay, there's a project going on by Dan Weld and his students at Washington, which is basically about this particular idea, which is, you know, they use information extraction techniques to build the info boxes, or complete them, or correct them, and then use HCI techniques to have people essentially give them information about whether or not whether or not the info boxes that they actually made are accurate. Okay, which is more or less the kind of thing I was talking about earlier, where you can combine collaborative and people and automated extraction together. Okay. Anyway, so we may not go all the way to how you can extract knowledge from unstructured text sources, but we'll see some parts of it. Okay. The frustrating part of information extraction lectures is going to be that, again, these two lectures can be a semester-long course. I mean, it's not, this particular topic can be a semester-long course. It's a very highly popular topic right now. Okay. The reason I probably can't go into too much detail is A, because we have a lot more things to do and we are almost towards the last four classes, and B, it's also the case that you can't really understand information extraction unless you understand natural language processing, at least at some level. You need to understand grammars, you need to understand, in fact, we'll point out in a minute that the grammar for English language is like XML schema for XML. Okay, and you need to know something, if you are into English language at any rate, then you need to understand, English language grammars and using them to do extraction. So I can't really teach you the intricacies of information extraction for A, because you need to know about the grammars, and B, because ultimately these are essentially statistical natural language processing techniques, which are almost indistinguishable from statistical learning techniques these days. Okay. And so I will give you sort of a bird's eye view about what the directions are, but it's not going to be like vector similarity or LSI, where you could explain the entire algorithm and you can redo it yourself. It's a whole entire field right now, information extraction. Okay, so this is basically saying that information extraction is supposed to be NLP, but we don't know how to do NLP. It's just that NLP light being done on the context of web. One advantage, of course, is that web does give one particular boost to natural language processing. It has massive corpus of pages. The plural of corpus is corpora. So, if you want to play this game, you want to say things like corpora without, batting an eyelid. So there is massive corpora of text pages on the web. Okay. So statistical techniques are actually feasible. In fact, we'll see, for example, that I mentioned to you a long time back that if you want to know whether water flows uphill or downhill, you can ask Google. It's not because Google is writing this. It's just that Google is indexing a huge number of pages. And it's statistically implausible for a whole bunch of people to say, describe the world that doesn't exist rather than describe the world that exists. Even though a few people will describe the world that doesn't exist, but it's improbable that majority will describe the non-existent world. Okay, so the corpus really makes NLP possible. And in fact, one of the interesting things is information extraction has taken from NLP and also given to NLP. Some of the techniques, because the advent of web has actually changed natural language processing significantly. In the old days, you would read natural language processing where you are essentially trying to tag you're going to first do part of speech tagging for a sentence, okay, and say this is a noun phrase, this is a verb phrase, this is the subject, this is the object, all that fun stuff, and then try to make sense from there as to what the semantics of the words are, things are. But now you can do other things. For example, for each word, you can then tag it into the WordNet, which is a huge online thesaurus of sorts, and then get other words that are related to that word. Okay. So in fact, statistical natural language processing has become much more feasible because of web, and using them on the web is information extraction of of a particular kind. Okay. In terms of history, there was this DARPA message understanding conference for a long time in the early 90s, which was essentially trying, can you do some reasonable amount of understanding of normal text, email messages, without doing full-scale natural language processing, which we don't know how to do. And then so they tried variety of tests and variety of competitions, etc. And in some sense, information extraction as a field came from that direction. Okay. The things that we could look at significantly, the easier kind of information extraction are, for example, very stylized text, such as news groups, for example, if you're trying to extract all job postings from the news groups, from Washington Post job advertisements, from LA Times job advertisements, etc., and put it in one single database. Okay, the monster.com is the one, right? That's like a job database. So how does that work? There are two ways it can work. One is people submit all their the job postings in the proprietary format that monster.com wants to monster.com. The other is they just go and crawl the web, extract job postings, convert them into a structured format. Right? If they do it, then they essentially have information extraction. They're using information extraction to do the job search. To extract job postings from normal text, which then can be, on the top of that, you can do normal database style query processing. Okay. So there are companies like monster.com, I guess. These are things, resumes. You can extract some information from the resumes, names and the fields of interest for people and so on. Seminar announcements, company information from the web. The thing that's interesting about all of these are, again, not literature. These are very stylized pieces of text where you expect to find certain types of information at certain places. Okay. In fact, the funny thing is there is a specific way people send MS thesis defense advertisements. Okay. If those of you who've been getting, I guess, these thesis defense advertisements, right, from the CSE.grad, and so there's a specific way they do it. Okay. And suddenly the other day, what's his name? This guy in fourth floor. What? Aviral Srivastava. He decided to write a literature piece for his student. Okay, now of course, it made me read it, because if I know that it's just yet another defense advertisement, I'll just skip over it. Because it's literature, I read it. He started up, bottom up, saying, made a life story about the student and why they were doing the defense, etc. But that's not exactly going to improve information extraction, right? I could read it because I understand English in my own weird way, but, the thing is that you want to write it in a stylized way so that extraction is feasible. And many of these are written that way, except Aviral students, MSc's defense.
So that's not like where you talk about templates.
Yes, exactly. Templated text, okay? And as you go, so the thing is, you go from here, this is very templated text, and as you go towards this side, this becomes less and less templated. Extraction is much more feasible for very templated text. Okay, so what we'll do today's class really talk about extraction from templated text. What is involved in extracting from highly templated text? Okay, and then tomorrow's class we'll talk about some of the ideas you can use for extracting from unstructured text. That means normal free flowing text. But when you get there, that's really fully natural language processing. But we'll try some ideas at least. Okay. Okay, this was basically the info boxes of Wikipedia that I was pointing out. It is sort of in between. This is full text, then there is some structure here, and then this is the info box. Okay, so this morning I was trying to add something on this, and then I didn't know which info box to use. I decided this because, Dan Rem's show this morning was talking about this great book called Giants, Lincoln and Douglas, which is a very interesting book. They were actually contemporaries, as you probably know from the history, and Frederick Douglass was one of the main players in that, because he was one of the two people that was talked about. So I put his webpage there. But you have little capsule summary of what Frederick Douglass was doing, there. Okay. Now a sample job posting might look like this, right? This is all English, right? But what you are trying to do is look for keywords. And these are sort of the keywords in red, okay? And then what you want to do is fill this template, okay? The assumption is that originally the job description was like this, since whoever wrote the job description felt you would like to read literature, they did a cheap imitation of literature, which is this. But if you are a program, you hate literature. You want your tuples back. So you get this back. So in a way, if this view of the world actually is not as far-fetched as it might seem. In fact, most of the jobs, most of the web pages on the web are dynamically generated. They're database backed. Okay, so there is like a job posting that might be there, and then you're generating a page to describe that posting for human eyes. Okay, so they wrapped a database tuple into English text. I gave you examples of this in the past, such as, you know, New Delhi, India becomes the capital of India is New Delhi. Okay, so they wrapped the text wrapped the database tuple into English, bad English. And then you need to unwrap it back to the tuple. Now, for reasons that I can't explain, the process of unwrapping is called wrapper. So a wrapper is a program which takes this and produces this. And its success is predicated on the fact that, you know, originally it existed this way. Somebody converted it this way, and so you could actually convert it back here, hopefully easily. Okay? Yes, there is still a question? There is a huge amount. I'm just getting the simple ideas first. Okay. In fact, even wrapper generation turns out to be very tricky, because every once in a while, you know, this is not exactly the simplest kind of wrapping. Okay. They put a lot more text here. Okay. But even the very simplest kinds of wrapping, where you take something like the tuple India, New Delhi, and write it into pretty, you know, simple, the capital of India is New Delhi, right? Even this can be tricky, because essentially you would probably want to say skip, 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 pick, put it in the country field, skip, put it in the capital field. That's the simplest wrapper. But that misses the fact that I might put in unnecessary unnecessary words in between, which doesn't change the meaning of the sentence for people, but it completely changes, you know, what's being extracted. Okay, what's more interesting is that even after you make a wrapper, people will start changing the way they convert it to English. And so you need to maintain the wrapper. So in fact, the first generation of the internet jobs, the web jobs, which used to be, you know, there used to be this company called Jungly, which got sold to Amazon, and there were other companies like that. They were all precursors of the today's monster.com, okay, and Flipdog. And they were all essentially based on the wrapper technology. So you generate a wrapper, okay, which unwraps the English data into a database tuple. And what they would do is they would actually pay money. This was at the height of the internet bubble. They'll pay people like you money, and you'd say, I work for an internet company, and what you're doing is writing skip, 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 pick, skip, skip, pick. That would be your wrapper. And your entire life is, every once in a while, the other end, New York Times, will change a little bit how they are writing the job posting. So you start getting junk. So then you look at it and say, oh, I'm getting junk in my job posting. So then you say, skip, skip, skip. If this is true, then don't skip. If this is true, then skip. Okay? So you're writing these complex wrapper programs. And if people ask you in the hometown, what are you doing? You say, I'm working on the web company. But really, it's no better than doing assembly language programming. Okay? And in fact, that's what they did for the longest time. And you know, essentially, before they got sold to Amazon. Okay? Some of these things at a research level can be automated. In fact, one interesting question, there are hidden slides, you know, in this particular topic that I'm probably not going to talk about, but you can look at them, and there is about wrapper maintenance. If the wrapper stops working, would you have to look at it? Or can the program automatically alert you that something went wrong? It turns out it's not that hard. Okay, so if in fact you know enough examples of the stuff that falls in the capital, okay, and suddenly you start finding double quote marks in the capital, you should be able to tell that, you know, those look like city names, these look like just punctuation marks, and it cannot be the same kind of a thing. Okay, so you would wind up learning classifiers saying, you know, so you have the positive and negative examples of things that fall in the capital field, and you learn a classifier based on that, and you keep applying that classifier to everything that just got unwrapped. And if a majority of them fail the classifier's test, then you wake up this hotshot web guy and say, look, your wrapper fell apart, so rewrite it. Okay, so you could do some of this kind of, you know, research techniques, and these techniques to maintain the wrapper. Okay, so, and then here is another example, Amazon book description. Okay, and this becomes much, much simpler because, in fact, you can see that Amazon generates its book description from an XML record. It takes the XML record, uses XSL to convert it into some HTML format. Do you understand what I'm saying? So they have all their database, their entire book database, in either relational or XML side. Okay? They use this XQuery translation queries to generate these. And you're saying, please don't generate this. Just give me the original one. Then I would be much happier. But they won't. They'll give you this. So you need to say, well, you know, get rid of all this structure and put it in the right format. Do you understand what I'm saying? So basically, from this, you want to be able to say, title is this, author is this, list price is this, and so on. Now, clearly, this is much easier to extract from, right? Because it already is, the idea is the original tuple was in the XML format. If they gave it to you, there's nothing to extract. Okay, because they would already have said, price is this value, and et cetera. So if I give you an XML file, you don't need to extract anything. Assuming everybody uses the same vocabulary, if they give you XML file, you don't have anything to do. It's because they don't give you XML file. Why don't they give you XML file? Because they think you don't want to see the XML file. So they convert XML to HTML, which gets rendered into the pseudo English. Now you are undoing it. So we create our own problems. Between Amazon and us, we created a nice little problem. Okay. However, the problem is easier in this case than, let's say, normal text, because this thing has a grammar, essentially. And the extraction can be, the extraction patterns can be expressed in terms of this grammar. Extraction patterns can be expressed in terms of this grammar. Okay? In particular, so what we've been talking about is essentially extraction from the templated text. The last two examples, especially the last example, is really about extraction from the templated text, where the templated text was originally generated from some structured tuple. You want to undo that translation. Okay? And so this extractor that you write is a wrapper. It's unwrapping, and so it's called a wrapper. Don't ask me why. And then the process of this extraction is also called, descriptively, screen scraping. You scrape pieces of information from the screen. Because they took a structured tuple, put it on the screen, okay, and you need to scrape it off of the screen. Now, one nice thing, of course, is if it was originally a structured tuple, and if, in fact, it's being written in the way I said, which is XML, using XQuery to some HTML format, then the HTML format has a DOM, a I mean, HTML also is XML. It's a subset of XML. So it has a DOM tree. Right? So you can write your patterns in terms of the DOM tree. You don't have to say skip, skip, skip. You can talk about it in terms of the subtree tree patterns. Okay, so first we need to understand if you have to write it, how would you write it? And then we'll talk a little about the fact that in fact you could learn these using inductive learning techniques. That's essentially also a reasonably popular research area where if I give you enough examples of HTML pages on one hand and the extracted tuples on the other hand, and in fact I show you how I extracted by highlighting, okay, then you should be able to learn what should be the pattern such that it will work. Basic inductive learning. Okay, it's not the kind of inductive learning, unfortunately, that you already have learned about, such as naive Bayes classifiers, but it's the kind of inductive learning that you would learn about logical learning, essentially. Like if any of you know version spaces, that's exactly what you do. Okay, version spaces is the kind of learning that you have to use. Okay? So if I have the DOM tree in front of me, then I can write my extraction pattern in terms of the structure of the DOM tree. Okay, so in this particular case, title is start from HTML, go to body, go to B, and then look for the character data. And so in essence, you can express this in terms of path expressions followed by a runtime variable, which is grabbed from the HTML tree. Okay, and then you take this title, and then you are making your own XML file now, XML tuple, which has a title as the begin title, and then this stuff will go there, end title. Begin author, this stuff will go there, end author. So really what you did was you went from XML to HTML back to XML. That's what is wrapping technology. This is a very useful thing in many scenarios because, in fact, the page itself is generated by a database which has a structured piece of tuple. Okay, there are obviously issues. There are challenges here too. So, in fact, I showed you the easy case here. So now, if I give you one more book, which has a body and after that some other element name whose sub-element happens to be the title, then you would have to say, oh, really, this is not enough, body, double dash, character data. So you start using path expressions with basically skip, 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 multiple times, as many times as possible until you see a B and then you can pick the character data. Right? In general, essentially, this you can express these in terms of XML path expression. Or you can express them in terms of general regular expressions, which is actually a superset of XML path expression. Okay? Let's see. So the kind of patterns, you know, you could also have patterns like this, which is basically just awk patterns, you know, awk the language. You know, you can use awk filters to pick up information from text files, okay? So you provide these kinds of patterns, which are, you can think of them generally as path expressions, which are saying, you know, how many times to skip. Sometimes you may skip multiple times until you find a certain element, and then you pick the next thing. Okay, so a wrapper hypothesis would be of this kind of a form. They are path expressions. You can write it by hand, or you can try to learn. You can actually say, this is your hypothesis space for your learner, and you keep showing multiple examples, and the learner tries to come with the right level of generalization. Okay? Let's see. So the idea of learning, essentially, is you, the human, takes examples. So you can do this wrapper generation in multiple ways. Okay, one is humans write it directly. The second level of automation is you make the life of humans easy in writing it. So all they need to do is, all they need to do in this particular case, let's see, where am I? Just a second. Okay, so this is on the Amazon. Okay, so they basically look at this. This is the HTML version, and on the screen there is a piece of information that you're seeing without all this markup. So the human would just basically highlight a portion and say title. Okay, and then behind the scenes, the machine, basically the program, can see that this actually corresponds to a particular part of the DOM tree. So then it quickly comes with a path expression for that. So that's automation to some extent, because at least you didn't have to write the path expression, just as you don't have to write the HTML for the page. You just write it in Word document or something and they convert into HTML. But the hard part is done by you, but you don't mind doing that because that's the easy part for you. Okay? And what's easy for the machine turns out to be boring for you, which is, you know, writing angular brackets, etc., or writing the patterns. That you can do. So that's essentially semi-automated wrapper generation. So you need at least an interface where the human is basically pointing out the parts of the page that correspond to various fields. So the assumption in this kind of templated extraction is that there is a template to be filled. It was known upfront that this job must be put into this template. Okay, this particular text has to be put into this template. So I must find a title thingy for it, a price thing for it, an author thing for it. Okay, now of course, if you give it, you know, instead of giving a book record, you give it a newspaper article record, it will still go ahead and find all these values. And you can laugh at it. But that's basically because it doesn't look at any more context. It assumes all the elements that are being shown are books. And so they are all going to have this structure. So if I do this default thing, I will get the information out. Okay. Now, in as much as I provided the GUI for humans to point out what parts of the page corresponds to what particular fields, you could also learn from that. You have multiple positive examples. In fact, one of the tricky problems is that learning with just positive examples is tricky. It's a weird kind of a learning. Okay, most of you who know classification learning know that learning actually works with positive and negative examples. If you only see positive examples, there's nothing to learn. You just say, every time I'll say yes. Now, even though that is the case, in fact, learning from positive examples is very much feasible under certain conditions. You know, we are examples of this. You know, if you ever have a kid, if you already have a kid, take this from me, that this is a scientifically proven fact, that kids don't learn anything from yelling. When you say, don't do it, they don't learn anything. Right? All negative examples, they throw it into the bit bucket. They mostly learn from the positive examples. This is at least the psychological literature. Of course, the kids may have paid the researchers to do this so that parents won't yell at them. But the reality is that, in fact, there are many situations where you do have only positive examples and you still have to learn from them. Okay. In fact, another example of learning mostly from positive examples is given examples of XML pages, learning the XML schema for those pages. Grammar induction is essentially positive example based. Okay, and if you want to understand how this makes sense in the case of kids, if you read that Noam Chomsky thing that I mentioned earlier in one of my mails, you know, kids come into this world with universal grammar. At least this is our understanding. This is our best understanding. They essentially have all that they need to tune their universal grammar machine to Telugu or English or Eskimo or any language. All they need is to figure out the tuning parameters for this. And so they have an already highly constrained hypothesis space. Okay, this is why they can't learn wolfies. I mean, even if the kid lives with wolves for a long time, they won't learn wolf language if they have one, because they don't correspond to the same grammar as human languages do. all human languages turn out to be special cases of this universal grammar, and so they can be learned from just the positive examples. And grammar induction in general is a classic case of learning from positive examples alone. Okay. And so anyway, so here is again a situation where you mostly, these humans are going to give you only positive examples. You can make some negative examples once in a while. You can show, look, I made this myself. What do you think about it? And the human says, that's wrong. That would be a negative example. Okay. But mostly what's coming from the humans would be positive examples. And that's an interesting kind of learning that you need to understand too, if you want to understand this. There is a paper describing how you could learn these kinds of LR expressions, these kinds of expressions, given, you know, enough examples, okay, in the readings for the information extraction. Okay. So that's whatever I described till now is information extraction from highly structured, templated text, where the meta assumption is that originally it was a tuple and it got converted into pseudo-English, so all you need to do is unconvert it. This is sort of, I think, the X-Files view of the world. The truth is out there, you know, you just have to find it, okay? Now, what if there is no truth out there? What if there was no original tuple to begin with and you're supposed to find all the facts that are there in the page? That's what we're going to talk next, okay? So I'll start today and mostly complete the discussion tomorrow's class. Okay, so information extraction from the unstructured text is, again, now, first of all, I think this part, automated support for semantic web, is unnecessary. I think it turns out all of these are support for semantic web, okay? Because how? Because if I take an Amazon page and I'm able to screen scrape my way out into finding a title, author, and list price, if I have a background ontology which describes, you know, how titles and authors and list prices are connected to each other, for example, it says authors normally are human beings. Human beings, are born at a certain time and die at a little later, and they can't live for infinite number of years and all that fun stuff. So you then can answer more questions than just the normal database style questions. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's the lever. The leverage you have is the huge, given the huge amount of background knowledge, a little amount of base level facts can get you a long way. If you have no background knowledge, all you can do is look at the base level facts and answer questions about them. You know, again, if you forget about what I said, remember the Magellan story. In the Magellan story, you don't need knowledge representation, hopefully, to answer questions such as how many times did he go around? Because I just told you, four times. So it is four. Okay? What's his name? I told you, Magellan. It's Magellan. The trickier question, such as which one did he die, you need the background knowledge. Okay? That's sort of the difference between database style query processing, where you can do selections, projections, joins about on that base level data, and inferences with respect to background knowledge that you can only do if you have the background knowledge. Okay, so even in this case, you are supporting semantic web because you have the background knowledge and then you took a text file, converted it into fields, and those fields are already basically, they're already been connected into the background knowledge. So you can answer more queries. If you don't have background knowledge, you can still answer like database style queries, which is still okay. Okay, so when we come here, then this is a question of a structured, unstructured text. So the question is, you no longer think that there was supposed to be a very specific template for this file. It's just grammatically correct English, hopefully. If it's English file, then it's grammatically correct English. If it's Japanese, it's grammatically correct Japanese, hopefully. Okay. So given that, what you want is from there, get tagged data and background knowledge. Now, in the previous case, I was getting tagged data by essentially saying this is the title, this is the author name, etc. Tagged data basically means RDF triples. And I assumed in the previous case that the background knowledge is just I have background knowledge and books somewhere. So this tagged data now becomes part of the background knowledge and I can do inference. I can also say, well, I can just get the background knowledge also from the web directly. I won't write anything myself. I want to also extract relations and axioms from the web Okay? If I want to do that, then the question would be, again, I want to use the information, basically the extraction from the English to do that. Okay? So we will look at two blue sky approaches when we come back tomorrow. Okay? One essentially it tries to do something slightly more, I mean, it basically does a slightly more interesting version of water flows uphill versus water flows downhill. Okay? If you want to learn that water flows uphill, sorry, if you want to learn whether water flows downhill or uphill is correct, okay, then you essentially call the search engine with water flows uphill once and water flows downhill once and compare the heat rates. It turns out you can use this also to say that Seattle is a city, okay? And if you think Seattle is a city, and you would say that what you would do is you would have an extraction pattern which is in terms of the English grammar, which says whenever you have a noun phrase is a another noun phrase according to your part of speech tagging, then this is a subclass or an instance of this. So once I do part of speech tagging for English text, I get the DOM tree for the English text. Okay, I mean, it's a weird thing to say DOM trees because grammar existed for English much before DOM trees existed for XML. But since we talked about XML first, if you do part of speech tagging for English text, and this is, you know, I'm sure you all had language arts teachers who made you learn how to do part of speech tagging and you hated them for that. Now if you know how to do it automatically, then you have the DOM tree for English text. Okay? And from that you can write these kind of patterns. These are hyponym patterns. Saying NP is a NP means NP would be an instance or a subclass of the other NP. So if I then say, if I look at a text, then I see Seattle is a city, then I would say Seattle must be a city. Now, I am open to the possibility that this whole thing is bogus. Maybe that is a has a slightly different meaning. So I want to check whether my extraction is correct. Rather than show it to people, I can check whether Seattle is a city or not. How do I do that? I check Seattle plus city divided by the Seattle. The Seattle plus city, how many pages in the world say Seattle as well as city together, and how many of them just say Seattle? Of the number of pages that say Seattle, how many of them say Seattle plus city together? And if you take that ratio, that gives you a feel for how likely is it that Seattle is a city. We'll look a variation of this to actually learn facts. Okay? And then we'll also look at a different idea, which if I already have a background ontology, which is more or less what I was hoping for in the book idea, where in the book's case I had a background ontology, and I learned, I tagged the pieces by extracting, by unwrapping the structured text. Here, without the structure, I will still use things like vector similarity ideas to realize that this word, the Jordan, Michael Jordan here, is really an instance of Michael Jordan, the player. And the moment I make that connection, then all the background knowledge can come to bear on the page. We will look at those two tomorrow. Okay? Thank you.